Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome everybody to Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today we have two guests, Dr. Mikael Kenny-Brunn. He's a social anthropologist at the University of Cambridge, where he works with Healthcare Improvement Studies Institute. His research focuses on the NHS mental health services in the UK, and he's a co-editor of a book I've read and got interested in, Towards an Anthropology of Psychology. Welcome, Mikael. And our other guest is Rebecca Hutton. She's a social scientist and associate lecturer with the Open University. Rebecca's worked in government and public health research and has extensive experience in researching NHS psychological therapies. She was a co-editor of Towards an Anthropology of Psychology. So you're both very welcome. And we're going to explore this idea of an anthropology of psychology. I mean, I got interested because, as I just said to you before we went live, I've written quite a lot about therapy culture and therapeutic culture and how it's just sort of endemic and people take it for granted. And yet in different cultures and different places, it shows up very differently. Where would you like to begin in your exploration of what your findings from the edited book you put together? Where would be a good place to start to explore this?
Do you want to start, Kenny, or how it came about, really? I mean, we both kind of met each other through an online network that was looking at sort of philosophy, really, of psychotherapy, having both done doctoral work, field work in psychological services in the UK, and discovered that, you know, there was a dialogue that was happening but not quite happening, and that we wanted to develop further based on our lived experience and our research experience in those settings, which had, for both of us, I think, thrown up a huge number of questions and observations about the familiarity and the strangeness of what goes on in the name of psychology and psychotherapy in different settings. It began with a podcast, actually, didn't it? In 2021,
yeah.
We got invited to do a podcast together, and I think that's how we got to know each other intellectually a bit. Mm-hmm. And here we are 4 or 5 years later, reflecting on the book, which came about as a result of those conversations, really.
Thanks for that introduction, Rebecca. Kenny, where would you like to begin with the narrative?
Yeah, thank you. I might just add also that I think from, as far as I remember, going back to this network, it was called Talking as Cure, Mental Health and Its Treatment, and was hosted by an institute in Cambridge called CRASH. And I think what was quite surprising to us in some ways, or perhaps not, was that from within the side disciplines, so like psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, psychiatry, and psychology, there's been a long-standing history of critical commentary on its own practices, philosophies, therapeutic modalities, and so on. But very little had been said, at least from within anthropology, about the psi disciplines and the psi institution. So, and that's despite anthropology and the psi disciplines having quite an interesting and complicated relationship historically from the late 19th century, and especially in the first half of the 20th century. So I think that was for both of us quite interesting, that what does it mean for anthropology to bring its own voice to the table here, and how might we study, as it were, and work with psi professionals? What would that kind of ethnography look like in anthropology specifically?
Yeah, it's a great lens to look through. Of course, it takes me straight back to Freud, and if you visited Freud's clinic, then he has lots of anthropological kind of symbols and items and stuff there. So it's at the heart of the work in the beginning, and then maybe gets lost somewhere. And
exactly. And interestingly enough, both the early psychoanalyst and the anthropologist, at least in British social anthropology, there was quite a tradition in criticizing each other's disciplines and coming at each other both as collaborators and also perhaps as intellectual enemies to some extent. But interestingly, as you're saying, both psychoanalysts had long used ethnographic data to back up or frame psychoanalytic frameworks and theories, and vice versa. Anthropologists had use psychoanalytic notions, concepts, and theories to understand and situate the ethnographic material, even if they were generally quite critical of psychoanalysis as well. So it was an interesting kind of collaborative and critical milieu, especially in the first half of the 20th century, I'd say.
Yeah. And then, of course, psychology and developed in a much more kind of, from psychoanalysis, which was more kind of a cultural perspective, it went much more into a scientific, empirical kind of measuring, cognitive behavioral kind of approaches, which kind of shaped it again in a very different way, isn't it?
Yes.
Rebecca.
Yeah, well, I mean, there have been big swings, as we know, in between which modalities are in favour at any particular point in time. And that in itself is interesting to study, isn't it, in terms of what that tells us about the wider social change and expectations from a therapeutic experience. And I guess because it's just longer established, I mean, there has been a lot more engagement and research in relation to what psychoanalysis is or what it represents for people, how people engage with it, than there has been with some of the more recent therapies, psychological therapies, as they're now called, and they're not even called psychotherapy anymore, which is partly what motivated my doctoral research and Kenny's, I think, because I was at the time working in a mental health research team engaged in evaluating new initiatives, which we were, you know, very big at the time in the terms of 2000 and the noughties, the 2008 Layard initiatives, and just wanting to understand what that explosion of interest was about and how to understand what it was like for people who were swept up in it, really. And training in it, and then being given the task of taking forward the nation's mental health. So I spent quite a long time actually engaged with the psychosocial perspectives on that. But more latterly, after finishing my PhD and having a breather, I've reflect back on that in a more anthropological way, and found that a very useful lens to use.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. I mean, just to share with the audience, I mean, my background is... is therapy. I was a general nurse, psychiatric nurse, and then I went into psychotherapy. So I did a master's in counselling and Rogerian kind of person-centered therapies, and then I got interested in family therapy. I was 10 years trained as a family therapist. Then I studied psychoanalysis, Lacanian psychoanalysis, and moved into Lacanian psychoanalysis. So I spent many, many years in the health sector, as both of you. So as a practitioner and observer, I mean, what I learned from a lot of that is how difficult it is for people kind of in these therapies to think beyond their own almost cult-like kind of division, you know. So you get these fights between them, you know, which is most efficient and which is best and stuff. But there's not a broader perspective. So I was very pleased. Can you say something about kind of what it means to bring an anthropological perspective before we go into some of your findings?
Yes, of course. So it might mean various things, really. I think a lot of anthropologists take a kind of broad church approach to the discipline in different ways. But I think what binds a lot of different anthropologies together, if we want to put in the plural, is the ethnographic method, right? So carrying out as much as possible long-term fieldwork, ethnographic fieldwork. And that might mean anything. I mean, in the context of the science disciplines, it might mean, you know, hanging out with clinicians, following their day-to-day clinical practices, attending meetings, going for coffee, going to the pub after work hours, attending conferences as well. So it can really go on many different kind of everyday professional practices. I'm specifically talking about the UK here, at least. So it's driven by ethnographic fieldwork, but it's also, more importantly, driven by the kind of questions and concerns that the people we work with have. So often you will find anthropologists having a very open-ended approach to their methodology. And I think that's a very distinctive feature of anthropology, that often the kind of method, even the methods we're using, whether we are using interviews or whether these are structured or informal and so on, the conversations we're having are very much dictated in some ways by what people expect of us, but also what is appropriate to the context. So it's a very kind of dynamic and in some ways inherently quite collaborative process of doing ethnographic fieldwork. So I would say that that's the kind of fundamental feature of the anthropological method here.
And were you able to, does the anthropological method, I mean, most of the psychological therapies are confidential, so you can observe the practitioners, right? But what about the actual practice? Was there any observation of the practice itself?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in the history of anthropology, it has often been the case, because of the ethics governance and issues of confidentiality and these spaces, the consultation rooms, for instance, being highly guarded spaces in ethical and regulatory terms, it has often been the case that the anthropologist, him or herself, were a trained psychologist or psychoanalyst and were then able to get access to those spaces by virtue of being a mental health professional mm-hmm. themselves. Many ethnographies or the few ethnographic studies there are of the side disciplines that's come out over the past 40, 50 years were conducted by people, by anthropologists holding this dual position of a clinician come ethnographer, which is interesting in and of itself, that has been methodologically and ethically incredibly difficult and still is to some extent to get access to these spaces.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's not uncommon in anthropology. You know, in anthropologists are used to going into, you know, joining initiatory cults or trying to get into different, you know, secret spaces and so on. So there is an aspect of that in the anthropological record and tradition already. But of course, in clinical and scientific spaces, there's another layer.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have complications that are added to that.
Yeah. And I think for me, I was able to do the research I did, which was within the NHS. Partly by virtue of the position I held as an official university researcher evaluating NHS services with working alongside clinicians who were engaged in the research. So as part of that research being required to interview clients, I didn't use that for my own research, but I was involved in evaluation that involved talking to clients. So I had some experience of listening to clients' responses to therapeutic interventions they were receiving. But in my own research, I talked mainly to clinicians about their experiences of it. So in that sense, it was one-sided. But I think I wouldn't have been able to do even that if I hadn't had the authority and bestowed on me by virtue of that position that I was happened to be in at that time.
Sure, sure. So you've got this perspective. What's come up? Let's share some of the findings from the book and some of what you discovered and some of the gaps as well. What's left to be discovered?
Well, we might start out by saying that it's an edited collection. So we have different chapters written by mostly early career anthropologists, with a few exceptions. So we have 7 chapters and an 8th, an afterword by Professor Kim Martin from University of Oslo. And the chapters span quite a diverse range of ethnographic and also geographic context. So we have a chapter from Italy, Canada, Burkina Faso, Uganda, and the UK, I think. Have I missed anything? No, Sri Lanka as well.
Sri Lanka, yeah.
So it's a good kind of selection of different places where we follow different, quite diverse, again, a diverse set of context. Some of the chapters are specifically about psychological counseling. Some of them are about a mixed psychiatric and psychological context of both treatment and assessment. Lia Scioli's chapter from Italy is about an eating disorder clinic and their treatment practices there. Some of the chapters, like my own, focus on the science as such behind psychotherapy and some of the scientific enthusiasms lately in psychological therapy and some of the more kind of regulatory transformations that we have seen in the discipline of psychotherapy more broadly. And then we also have a chapter by Jennifer Kearns, who talks about the development of digital mental health apps and technologies, which is obviously a very
topical,
timely, very topical issue now. We get digital mental health everywhere.
Yeah. Rebecca, do you want to share anything which stood out for you in this research? What kind of stands out for you?
Well, of course, I'm biased, but I do think the book has some really great material in it in terms of sort of ethnographic insight vignettes, capturing moments of interaction or conversations between people which elucidate their understandings, engagements with the discourses and practices of psychology, how they engage with them, how they understand them, how they kind of adopt them and also resist them, you know, all of those different forms of engagement in some quite surprising ways. So, you know, we see, you know, a client in Canada, for example, who, you know, kind of takes this sort of what bricolage approach to mental health. You know, she has an ongoing relationship with a doctor who has a certain view of her condition, a rather fixed view, And she's constantly both trying not to alienate them, but then to resist, you know, and to rework with that experience. And then using the ethnographer, the research as a sounding board to kind of explore in her own mind what she's doing and how she's going to manage her own mental health differently. I think it just gives a much, we have such a diverse range of ways in which people, as you say, engage with and understand and use psychological ideas for their own purposes or for their own improvement or sanity, which sort of goes against some of the, as you say, the normative or critiques or discourses that we see around therapy culture and therapeutic ideas. So, yeah.
Thank you. Kenny, what about you? What stood out for you?
I think what I think is quite novel, perhaps, in the book is that we, in a sense, and that was very a kind of very deliberate move, I think, from our side, and that was that we wanted to not just bring in an anthropological voice by talking about culture. So that's already come up, you know, the idea of therapeutic cultures, but also cultures of psychology. That has been a very common language in anthropology and the social and human sciences to frame and situate and contextualize the side disciplines. And that was not a language of analysis that I personally found very useful. And that was generally an idea that we discussed in our workshops we had with the authors. Are there other ways in which we can investigate and explore and examine psychological theories and models without always having to situate those in the language of culture? So that's not to say that the language of culture isn't important, but it is ethnographically interesting that people might understand their own professions through the language of a professional culture, a therapeutic culture, and so on. So I think that was quite new about this kind of anthropological engagement with a side discipline. So you have a parallel sub-discipline, a sub-field in anthropology called psychological anthropology, which is very dominant or very big in the U.S., largely developed in the U.S., came out of the culture and personality school there. It has been very common to use that language and also by transcultural psychiatrists and so on, the language of culture. That's how we can say something about psychology from a kind of social perspective.
Yeah. What about, the psychological therapies, psychotherapy, the talking cure, we have an idea of a reflective self which can be worked with. Did that reflective self show up in all the studies or did it differ? Did it show up differently? Is there like there's a very westernized idea of a reflective self, which came from the, you know, the early confessional, you know, you looked at yourself to see whether you were a sinner or not a sinner. And that's where it came from. It kind of went on that trajectory. But what about other cultures you've been studying? Is that reflective self present? Is it different?
Yes. I mean, that's a very big question and a very interesting one. I think you'll probably find very different takes on that question within the discipline of anthropology, depending. And I think a lot of those answers to that question will at least ideally be guided by the ethnographic context and the worlds that the anthropologists are living in. I think what's very interesting to me, at least, I can only speak for my own work, is that the idea of the individuated, self-contained person with a capacity to reflect and decide is an interesting and incredibly important invention, right? So it is, and that's not to say that it's made up, but it is to say that capacity to reflect that we see in biomedicine and internals and psychology and psychotherapy is a very interesting development that took shape within very particular kind of historiographical periods in Europe and in the US. And we see that very much. I mean, the side disciplines were part of establishing and reifying this capacity. And it's also a capacity that is taken for granted. But then, of course, we might go to elsewhere in the world and people might not quite think about their own human interiority in quite those terms, a reflective sense of self. That's not to say that people don't think or reflect, but it might not be a kind of reflective self in quite the same ways that we are taking for granted in European psychology.
No, I mean, I've recently come back from China. I did some work there, and I've been last year I was in Africa doing some work and different in Zimbabwe, South Africa, Kenya, and it's very interesting that, you know, that I got a sense of similarities and differences, you know, around kind of an extended self. the potential of the extended self. I think it does come up in one of your case studies I read, where the individual was going to a traditional counselor and then going to traditional healers and moving between them and selecting kind of different ways. And it kind of gave me an idea of an extended self where you weren't just kind of like this interior self being looked at. You kind of had connections to a spirit world, to a therapy world, to a kind of ancestral world.
Right.
Which is very interesting.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting. It's a point that Kier Martin elaborates on in his afterword, in his chapter. And that is that I think anthropology has often been credited with highlighting or pointing to the relational or individual, if you will, person and how a person might indeed, as you're saying, be extended or distributed in social relationships and so on. But that point about relationality here was actually one that came out in part of psychoanalytic thinkers before it entered anthropology. So there's an interesting history here, even though we often kind of think about, you know, in anthropology is kind of taken for granted assumption that human beings are inherently relational beings and that those relations extend very far also into relations with non-humans and an environing world as well. I think what's really important to highlight, and that's, you know, when we're talking about critiques of, say, a very highly hyper-individualized or individuated person or self, we also, at the same time, have to remember that different psychotherapies have been very good at exploring the ways in which human beings are relational in all sorts of ways. And the way in which those relations are constituted, not only in a kind of clinical context, but also in everyday scenarios, and how that is that whole kind of deeply relational biographical person that is brought into the consultation, for example. And I think in that way, you know, for the anthropologist and perhaps also for the psychotherapist, psychotherapy and anthropology are similar in some important ways, right? By highlighting and exploring that those relations, and perhaps the similarities are more striking than the differences, at least to those people who know both disciplines.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's huge limitations in the psychotherapy, psychological world around relationality, that it's quite a limited perspective, that it's very selective, the way we think about it. It gets confined. I mean, you know, as a family therapist, we move into systems thinking. We think about the relationships, obviously. You know, that's why I moved into family therapy from individual work, because it was obvious to me that working with an adolescent, that adolescent's not in isolation, and anything they're bringing to the clinic is actually part of them and beyond them as well, you know, so it's relational. So you understand it through family ways. But very quickly, I then started to work with the police and with the social services and with teachers, because you realize that relationality with just family wasn't enough either. Like, you know, the individual was connected in a, and most family therapists wouldn't work in you know, that it's still quite restricted in the kind of view. And it's, it kind of interests me. What about, I mean, anthropology, people kind of, in their minds, people don't know about anthropology. They think about people going into different continents and looking at kind of primitive peoples and things. You know, that's kind of the idea. But for me, taking an anthropological look at the psi disciplines, they're very tribal, actually. Very tribal in a way that you kind of interact. Do you want to say anything about that? Did that come up at all in your work?
I guess it's a bit of a truism in a way, you know, with any professional training, but perhaps particularly with the psychological training. It certainly came out in my field work, this sort of, it's almost a physical response you get when you brush up against these kind of core concepts or core understandings, which just frame the whole approach, and which are not questioned or are only latterly questioned when you ask. For me, in CBT, you know, it was partly that idea of cultural competence, partly you know, some certain phrases that would come up again and again, like we're trying to find simple solutions for complex problems. You know, we're working in a constrained system. This is what we're doing, and how differently people engage with those, and then how it affected me listening, observing to those things. You don't know it until you rub up against it, I think, until you stumble across it and suddenly think, whoa, what's going on? What's that about? And then trying to understand what the people you're working with understand by it as well. And as soon as I started asking people what they understood by simple solutions for complex problems, it was a surprising range of responses. There were a lot of people who really struggled with it. and for whom it was their undoing, and a lot of people for whom it was a challenge and a positive motivation. So starting to get some of those different stories and perspectives on it was really what became very interesting, and I think is what anthropologists try to do.
And to add to that, I think coming back to the question of perhaps a kind of the 19th century caricature of anthropology, which is still well and alive in some ways, that, you know, we deal with tribal or savage societies. I mean, anthropology has, of course, moved beyond that very much in the 20th century. But I think what is interesting to me, in also what you said, Rebecca, the questions that we ask as ethnographers are, in some ways, we start out in anthropology, at least methodologically, to treat material and practices and ideas as we would treat them elsewhere in the world, right? So even though we might study in a highly clinical scientific context, say in the UK, we are, as a starting point, engaging with those practices with an kind of ethnographic gaze, as it were, right? And we are trying to be quite relativist about it. So we are trying to at least momentarily dispense with our own taken for granted and cherished ideas about what makes, you know, what is mental health, for instance, or what makes a good life and so on. And that's something I think that, you know, that can be difficult sometimes. People don't always understand what an anthropologist is doing in those spaces. But we are, I think, one of the advantages of an approach of what anthropologists would say, you know, rendering the familiar strange and vice versa, rendering the strange familiar. These are phrases you will hear often muttered in anthropology lectures. But one of the advantages of really doing that, truly rendering the familiar strange, at least as a first step of investigation, is that you will see that indeed many of our taken for granted notions about mental health and the practices that are taking shape around them are ethnographically interesting. They are, you know, they might not be as culturally distant as other practices, but they're still very interesting, and they tell us stories about what it means to be human. And I suppose that's really what the discipline is about, right? We are exploring what it means to be human.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm not trained in anthropology, but I often say to people, I feel like I'm an anthropologist because my work takes me into, I work in like global tech firms. I work in kind of global manufacturing firms. I work in small businesses. I work in hospices. I work in humanitarian sector in different countries. So you work in all these different kind of spaces and places with kind of different cultures. And I try and go in and I try and take that perspective because it's really interesting to go in a kind of naive, kind of open way and trying to feel what practices are happening there and trying to kind of, rather than go in with a preset of ideas thinking I'm there to consult to them and help them develop their leadership training. I'd say I was working in a major car in the industry and I say to them, you know, I can't do any work with you unless you let me walk the floor. You know, I need to kind of walk along the production line and I need to feed it for 3 days first and then I can do some work with you, you know. And it's just really, really interesting to set that perspective. And I think it's a shame that people don't kind of utilize, you know, that perspective, even if they're not fully trained anthropologists. I think it's a very, very useful way of trying to open things up to try and understand things, but humanity works in a better way. I think it'd be very useful to have that as part of other people's training.
And it's not without problems either. I think it's important to be allowed to also ask these questions, and it's not always possible to also be taken seriously and to be invited into these spaces in which such questions can be asked. So that's also an important point. It often requires a lot of negotiation to enter those spaces and to have those conversations. I think coming back to the language of culture here, I think a lot of anthropologists have been brought in to say something about culture historically, right? And they're still often called on to say something about the cultural context. Indeed, in my own research at the moment, you know, that's kind of how we are placed within the fieldwork that we do in NHS. You know, we will finally say something about a staff experience and the cultural context and bringing in that competency. But obviously culture, and that was a language that would introduce its own notion of context and meaning. But obviously that language has its own problems in a way, because if we are framing and understanding a lot of these issues, it could be patient safety or whatever clinical issue that a clinician might deal with, always through the language of culture, we might miss some important differences here, because culture, as we know, is often brought in, especially in that cultural competency training framework that Rebecca was talked about, as a kind of common umbrella term to deal with a lot of different differences, right? Sexuality, gender, race, ethnicity, and so on, that are lumped together within that cultural competency framework. And that is, you know, is problematic in all sorts of ways.
Yeah. The work of ethnographic kind of looking at practices, I think, is very helpful. I really like to just, rather than kind of go in with a set of assumptions or trying to identify what the culture is, you know, is it, you know, we get kind of cultural, in the leadership context, you get kind of cultural frames and say, is it this, is it that, you know, but to actually observe practices is very, that kind of specific kind of looking at how things are done, what, you know, what actually happens is just really, really interesting. Really fascinating, and gives you a different level of understanding.
Yeah. Culture is what you do, not what you are or how you're being described.
We're coming to an end of the podcast. Is there anything you'd like to say which hasn't been said? Anything comes to mind which you'd like to share before we round up?
I was just thinking of this connection with the themes that I've heard you talk about in your other podcast, really, just in terms of soul, the soul is and all of this, and also just what we were talking about just now in terms of what clinicians, the experience of some of them looking at us as researchers going in there, working anthropologically with a certain degree of envy and wishing that they could also stand back and look at what they're doing with a more open perspective rather than being constrained by expectations of their disciplines. So, I think for both of us, this has been a soul project, not one that we were paid to do.
Sure.
We both have given up a lot of free time for, but have enjoyed very much.
Yeah, well, the book's very, very interesting. I recommend anybody who's interested to take a look at it. I end every podcast by asking my guests if they have anything to say on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. These are huge questions, but I throw them out there just to see if anthropology or your work so far led you to any thoughts on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. You don't have to answer. You.
Well, I mean, interestingly, as this book shows, is that mental health has been called on as a category that makes sense of both society and life in all sorts of ways, and has now been used both as a measure and as a language to make sense of what it means to live a good life. And it's interesting, obviously, in that we have also seen in recent years a shift very much from the notion of mental illness to mental health, which is also about, which is reflected also more broadly in the social, human and political sciences, with a keen interest now in happiness, in joy, prosperity, well-being. You know, bringing hope into the analyses. I think that's really interesting. You know, where there's have been a move in anthropology away from the suffering subject, as people called it, to the good. To an anthropology of the good. A renewed focus on mental health is part of that enthusiasm.
Thank you, Kenny. Any last words, Rebecca?
I think I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Been really, really interesting. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Bye.